Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Welcome to the second episode, the difficult second episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Laura.
And...
Ben.
We are going to talk about The Imitation Game today, but before we do, some very exciting news. We have had our first subscriber.
Woo!
I'm hoping we got more than one, but I just know that we had our first one, and he's called Achintya. He works for the CMS experiment at CERN and the Large Hadron Collider. That's a pretty cool first subscriber. Hello, Achintya.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
That's really good. Today we are talking about The Imitation Game, which is the new biopic. Is that how we say it? Biopic?
Biopic sounds a bit like myopic. No, I'm not going to go there. Let's say biopic.
Okay. Biopic. Is that the same as biofilm, or is that something else?
I don't know.
That's definitely a biological term.
But that's science-y. Maybe we could do one of those.
Yeah.
Maybe that could be the next episode, biofilm.
Okay, this is the Alan Turing biofilm.
Biofilm. I've heard it described as an American-British historical thriller.
Oh.
I feel it
that
really...
That sounds good.
That's punchy.
It's dramatic.
Anyway, it's all about Alan Turing, and it stars Benedict Cumberbatch, who we do have an interview with. I had an opportunity to speak to him before I saw the film, and I asked him what had attracted him to the role of Alan Turing.
A really fast-paced, witty... incredibly involving and deeply moving script. It read like a thriller, like a love story, and you feel you're discovering him and what he was at the same time as his puzzle and unraveling.
Apologies for the sound, I hope it's clear enough. I was speaking to him on the phone, obviously, he's a very busy man. As I say, I hadn't seen the film at that point. I was very excited to see the film. I should just say there's going to be spoilers.
We will be talking about the entire plot. Yes. Of The Imitation Game. We will be spoiling some aspects of real life and how the film relates to real life.
Yes.
So, yeah. A lot of spoilers this episode.
If you don't already know about Alan Turing, we're going to spoil that by telling you a bit about him. There's also going to be a poem. Should we do the poem?
Right.
I feel we need a jingle at the start of
this. Should we make one up?
Yeah.
Poem, it's Ben, poem.
Poem. That was your cue. It's Ben's point.
All right.
We rehearsed then.
I can see.
Last week we had a haiku, a Japanese poem. This week, Andrew has asked me to write the poem for The Imitation Game in the form of a shijo, which is a traditional Korean form of poetry with three lines, each of around 14 to 16 syllables. Okay. In testing times... he deciphers, resplendent in enigmatic tweed. His brain clicks round, four up, two down. His appeal, not universal. An odd duck, a good egg, a bad apple, a silent death.
Thanks, Ben. So The Imitation Game looks at the life of Alan Turing from... three different points in his life, three different times in his life. I really loved the film, not just because of it spreading the word of Alan Turing's work and life and getting that message to more people, but as a film in itself, I think it's a brilliant drama, beautifully acted. It drives forward really well. It sort of takes you on the journey, and as Benedict says in the interview, you feel like you're discovering him as he's cracking the code. Ben, what were your expectations going into it?
You could tell from the trailers it was going to be quite a populist, entertaining film. It was directed by Morten Tildum, who previously directed Headhunters, which was a really enjoyable, quite dark thriller. So I was intrigued by that. The cast, really interesting. I really enjoy Matthew Good. He was absolutely fantastic in Stoker. If you haven't seen Stoker.
No. That's a fantastic film. That's a fantastic... Yeah. You definitely need to watch that.
Yeah, and obviously I've enjoyed Benedict Cumberbatch in loads of stuff. I mean, recently Parade's End. Really beautiful performance in that. Really layered. Just so much going on. I was looking forward to it.
I really, really enjoyed the film. I really did. And I was completely swept along with Alan Turing's character, and I felt that was portrayed really nicely.
I think the relationship between Joan Clarke and Alan Turing is portrayed really movingly in the film by Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley. I think that's really one of the strengths of the film.
Lots of good character actors in the background. Bletchley Park looks fantastic. And obviously it's really important that the story of Alan Turing is getting out to a wider audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's pretty much a stated aim of the film, is to get the story out there, to get a populist film to attract a wide audience and get Alan's story out there. I did ask Benedict how much he knew about Alan Turing before taking on the role.
To the majority of people, he's not that well known.
No.
And, you know, I have to remind that and say the same. You know, the more I discover about this man, as I read about him, as I played him and researched him, you know, he should be on the front cover of textbooks. He should be on banknotes. He should be celebrated as one of our national heroes. He certainly should be held up to Darwin and Isaac Newton.
I left the film wondering why I didn't know the story in full.
Right.
I felt like I should have known the story in full before going in.
Yeah. And you, Ben?
I felt that I knew a bit about Alan Turing's life and a little bit about his work. I went to university in Manchester and I remember sort of reading about his life. There's a statue of Alan Turing in a park in Manchester. There's been a road named after him. I'd heard a really great episode of Radiolab, which is about his life and links into the Turing test, how that developed. Mm-hmm. So I guess I had some background, not loads at all, not by any means, but he was a figure that I was aware of.
After the war, Alan Turing worked at Manchester University doing his research there, and it was actually in Manchester that he died or committed suicide. I'm from Manchester.
Yes.
As you can tell from my strong Mancunian accent. But I didn't know anything at all about Alan Turing going through school. I left school in 1994. The road name was changed in 1994 to Alan Turing Way. And that was the first time that I'd ever asked the question, who's Alan Turing? Why have they changed?
Yeah. Why is there a name?
And obviously that's why they changed the road name. But 1994 is quite a long time after Alan Turing died.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that story, as somebody born and bred in Manchester myself, I should have known his story. It should be embedded in the psyche of everyone in Manchester, but not just Manchester, the world. Alan Turing is widely celebrated as the father of modern computing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening to this podcast, arguably it might never have happened if it wasn't for him.
And his kind of big breakthrough was the concept of the universal machine. Mm. So before then, from Charles Babbage onwards, people were thinking of machines that would do calculations, that would simplify maths. And Turing conceptualised the idea of a universal machine that could do pretty much everything. It didn't have to be programmed in one way. It could turn itself to any problem. And yeah, the way he conceptualised that was an infinite piece of tape with zeros and ones that could then be programmed to perform any task. And that was the universal machine. There were other people working on the idea of computers, but it was that then led to our modern concept of a computer as something programmable, as something digital that could adapt.
He's also thought of as the father of artificial intelligence. Is that fair?
Well, he designed an experiment that's nowadays known as the Turing test. It's an attempt to find whether a machine is intelligent or not. He wanted to develop a machine that could, in turn, learn as well. It could develop and it could learn.
This was something that he was fascinated by. Can a machine recreate the process of the brain? Are our brains basically machines? And can we then recreate a complex enough machine that it can do everything that a human brain can? Now it happens every year that people submit their AI programs to find whether a machine can fool a human into thinking it's intelligent.
There have been a couple of occasions where at least it's been proposed that a machine has fooled the judges. There was one in June of this year, actually. I believe that it fooled the judges to think it was a 15-year-old boy or something, which doesn't seem quite the spirit of the endeavour. Turing's idea is based on an old parlour game where a man and a woman would go into a separate room and answer questions, and then a judge had to guess who was the man and who was the woman from the questions.
That's a really nice way of visualising such a complex.
When I was talking to Benedict, actually, he had quite an interesting take on Turing's work on artificial intelligence.
His entire work was almost about that. It was almost about the differentiation between the real and the artificial, and how we've constructed a world by which, you know, we can actually, we have to struggle to tell the difference because we have empiricized ourselves. He wanted to have something that was provably as good as human, but made through maths and logic, to debunk the idea that there was some kind of magic at the core of everything. You know, the spiritual for him was attainable through logic, through the beauty of the wonder of what we were capable of, what logic was capable of.
I've never, ever heard a good definition of the word spirituality, but if it means a joy and a
sense of wonder.
Yeah, and awe about something. And if that's what it means and that's what Turing got from science and logic and mathematics, then I think that's something that, well, it's certainly something that I can relate to. And I think there's an interesting question there. Are we, as human beings, just machines?
Are we biological machines? Is everything we experience just a chemical reaction in our brain? Are we just under the impression that we're in control of our emotions and our beliefs, or are they completely worthless? You'd like to think that we're more than just a machine. You would like to think that we have more of a purpose and a meaning, and that we're not just so clinically interacting with each other. We are a product of our environment and the influences we've had since we were born. But I think there's so much more than just being a series of reactions caused by stimuli, caused by other people interacting with you. And I think that if you have the capacity for having morals and good and bad and the ability to learn, we can love. We have friendships, we have emotions, we have morals, we understand the good and the bad. And I think that saying we are just machines is a very clinical way, very simplified way of looking at it. I don't think we're just machines.
We're universal machines.
We're universal.
We're universal machines.
We have an infinitely long piece of tape inside us.
If everything that we are is a function of our bodies, it's an incredible thing. And the science would suggest that we are a function of our brains. When people have serious brain traumas, they lose parts of their personality, or their entire personality, or their sense of self, which suggests very strongly that the sense of self is a function of the organ of the brain. And I think that in no way does that make life worthless. It takes no magic away from life. It just makes it more interesting.
There's not just the Turing test for artificial intelligence. For example, there's also the Ada Lovelace exam, which looks at whether an artificial intelligence can create an artistic artifact. Whether it's a story or music, it doesn't have to be good necessarily, but it has to fool people into thinking that a person could have created it. So that's
almost like real art. Then.
Almost like real art. Yeah, absolutely.
Has anybody passed? Has any computer passed the test?
As with the Turing test itself, that's still being worked on. Okay. But we've just finished NanoGenmo.
Go on.
NanoGenmo.
Yeah. Who's she?
Is National Novel Generation Month.
Oh.
Which, of course, NanoGenmo comes from NaNoWriMo.
Of course it does.
Yeah. National Novel Writing Month, where people write novels in a month. But National Novel Generation Month is a new, I think it started last year, people who are interested in creating artificial intelligences, writing programs, set them the task of writing novels. So far, that's resulted in kind of adaptations of older books, but with Twitter-style dialogue kind of laid on top of them. It hasn't quite fooled anyone yet, but yeah. It's on its way.
It's quite a compelling idea, isn't it, that Turing believed quite firmly that one day machines would think in the same way that human beings did. But he also proposed that idea almost as a carrot for other computer scientists, although they didn't exist or certainly weren't called that then, to strive for that, and that would take us to places that that maybe we didn't imagine before.
Yeah, a challenge.
Yeah.
To other researchers.
And it's certainly something that comes up a lot in sci-fi, doesn't it? I mean, immediately Blade Runner springs to mind for me.
There have been a number of portrayals of Alan Turing, stage and screen and books. Most influentially, I think, was Breaking the Code, which was a play by Hugh Whitemore. It was made into a BBC film in 1996 with Derek Jacobi in the lead role. That itself was based on a very influential biography by Andrew Hodges called Alan Turing, The Enigma, which first came out in 1983. There's been several other stage versions, a play called Love Song for the Electric Bear, a musical called The Universal Machine, which came out last year, and of course the Pet Shop Boys have created a musical biography of Alan Turing, called A Man from the Future. There was a really good episode of Horizon from the 90s, which I found on YouTube. Maybe it's still up there. I wouldn't want to recommend that, but it's there. Breaking the Code, the BBC play, is also, or was, also on YouTube. There was a Channel 4 documentary about all of the codebreakers at Bletchley Park called Station X. And Alan Turing has turned up in lots of books. There's a novel called Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson, where he kind of appears. Yeah, he's there in the culture, but as you said, maybe his name isn't known as widely as we should. The tragic side of his story is obviously something that has inspired a lot of these works, and the fact that he had to keep his sexuality secret, because by all accounts he kind of didn't. He was pretty open in real life about his sexuality, but that he was punished by the state for his sexuality.
The same state that he had worked for as well, which is just so ironic, so unfortunate.
Yeah. It's an incredible story. Let's have a listen to what Benedict thought about the character of Turing.
He was a child who was fostered and had a stutter from the age of, well, his mother came back from the diplomatic in India with her father to discover at 4 he had a stutter. It was shocked, but you know, this is obviously a very sensitive child left in the care of people who weren't necessarily brutes, but weren't his actual blood parents. And he obviously needed that. And I think from that age on, he turned inwards, because a child trying to make the normal social bonds who had a stammer in the 30s. I mean, can you imagine the sort of other 30s and 20s who had the level of ostracization he would have experienced?
Yeah.
Of course, Benedict isn't the only person to play Alan Turing in the film. He's also played very beautifully by
Alex Lawther.
And there's a scene where he's sitting under a tree at school with the young Christopher, played by
Jack Bannon.
And they're discussing code breaking.
Christopher's got a book of code breaking. Mm-hmm. And Alan says, people talking never say what they mean.
It's a very logical way of looking at it.
Yeah, it places the character of Alan Turing very firmly on the spectrum. That he's kind of looking at other people as puzzles, but it also kind of puts him at a remove from the other people, from society, and that is echoed throughout the film in the conversations about sandwiches and lunch. They just can't quite click in with kind of everyday conversation.
For me, that was a massive clue into understanding how this man was from the beginning marked out sadly as being somebody who was struggling to be part of a group and a whole, who would differentiate it, who was seen as being other, different, outsider, which kind of galvanized him into that lateral thinking, into having his imaginary world, his singular, extraordinary, but very peculiar and different focus, you know, not being a team player. And again, I think that's another part of how his mind started to form and obsess over maths. And then this burgeoning relationship with his boy is unrequited love affair.
Yeah.
With a student who was better than him. So this burgeoning secret love, fostered with a relationship, you know, that hinged on a love of maths and the intellectual pursuit of it and the introduction of a secret language to communicate with, which is sort of intoxicating. And that, I think, was the beginning of the idea of him living two lives, of him living a secret life. After he sort of tried to take in his achievements as a man who loved, and a man who had to live his life in secret because of that, a man who then had the biggest secrets to both break and keep again in the war. And then afterwards, whose one secret was exposed to his ruin. I mean, the sickening irony of that, you know, on top of that, and also that a man who had saved a nation and a government was then rewarded by that nation and government for his sexuality by being given the choice of 2 years imprisonment or state-sanctioned chemical castration through weekly estrogen injection. It's appalling. And, you know, you do see that still going on. Whenever nationalism rises, whether it's ISIS or the Golden Dawn in Greece or what's going on in Russia, you know, the same minorities are persecuted.
Coming out of the screening that I went to, was just struck by how tragic the story is. To have it up there on the big screen just brings it home again, how ridiculous the world was and still is in part. And that's a real strength of the film, I think.
I find it particularly effective at the end with the text coming up on the screen, and it says that in 2013 Alan Turing was granted a royal pardon for being accused of gross indecency. One kind of take-home message was, why did it have to wait until 2013? And does that mean that there are many other people out there who will not be granted a pardon because they didn't, in the eyes of the government, contribute as much to society as Alan Turing did, and therefore they're not being pardoned?
Even though that wasn't very long ago, which is just terrible, terrible, terrible to think about. But here we are, with that film being released now, and there isn't, I hope, at least, there are no questions about a problem of homosexuality being portrayed in a film. I'm sure there are parts of the world, as Benedict says, where that would be a problem. But I feel like the world is going in the right direction, and this film and others like it can be a part of that move.
So you just have to hope that the film is not only a science communication tool, it's not only raising awareness of the work that was done in Bletchley Park, but you also hope it raises awareness that homophobia is still a problem.
The film has been criticised as being historically inaccurate, so perhaps we should just discuss the authenticity of the film. If we go back to episode one and talking about Interstellar and Christopher Nolan's use of real sets, it's quite interesting that Moulton Tyldum also wanted to, in a sense, create authenticity. It's something that he talks about, authenticity, by going to the real historical locations that these things happened and filming there.
I mean, there's lots of different levels of authenticity. Visually, the film feels authentic. For me, there were some moments which didn't ring true as a drama. There's the conflict with Matthew Good's character, Hugh Alexander, the dashing chess champion. It's this kind of, you know, antagonism which feels really kind of slotted in to create that sort of drama within the group. So there are moments where it felt kind of forced. It felt inauthentic to me watching the film. So that's kind of one level. When you actually go away and start reading about Alan Turing's life or watching some of the documentaries, I mean, history is history, it's the past, it's another country and all that. But from what we know, have got quite a good picture of what Alan Turing was like and his contribution to the Bletchley Park team, all that stuff. So when you start to unpick it, there are many, many differences between the life of Alan Turing and the Enigma Code breakers and what is portrayed in the film, The Imitation Game. If you want to look into that in detail, there are some interesting articles out there. One of my favourites is just called An Alan Turing Expert Answers Your The Imitation Game Questions.
That was well written. I did enjoy that, as you said.
It comes from the point of view of this guy really enjoyed the film as an entertainment, but here are some of the things which were different in reality. And that's the other level of authenticity, which is just interesting to think about, I think.
Absolutely. I think there's definitely, as that article puts it, I think it's a really good way of looking at it. Go and see the film with your entertainment head on. come away from it, explore more. And it enables you to do that, and it's getting to a wider audience.
There's plenty of ways in which the film is authentic. I just find it very interesting that they've taken a story which is about a brilliant mathematician brought in to the circle, the Bletchley Circle, to be a part of that team. And by all accounts, he worked as an integral part of that team throughout that time. And he helped to perfect the machine. He helped to crack the Enigma code. That's kind of widely documented as the story. The film has kind of shifted that to a sort of lone gun guy, a maverick, who comes in to the Bletchley Circle, who aren't doing very well. They aren't working on machines. They're working in their heads and on bits of paper. And he kind of revolutionizes it with his way. Of course, he does have help from some of them eventually, but it's kind of about the hero making the difference. And that shift, obviously, we don't know where that came from in the film, whether it's from the screenwriter or development executives or producers, whether it was inspired by the hero's journey.
What's the hero's journey?
Joseph Campbell, who wrote a very influential book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is something we'll probably be talking about a lot on this podcast.
You will.
Because it was a massive influence on Star Wars.
Oh, we will.
Oh, we definitely will.
Loving the teaser trailer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah, it influenced spherical droids, I believe. That's where it came from. No. So this book was a big influence on George Lucas when he was writing Star Wars. And the book is about how lots of myths kind of have similar elements. And he kind of put this all together, the concept of the monomyth, or the hero's journey. And it's become one of those things that's used a lot in screenwriting and in story development. It was never intended by Joseph Campbell to be a sort of backbone for a story structure. It was an interesting way to look at myths and why they're important. But what's happened in Hollywood is it's become almost a mantra that good stories have to have the 17 elements to the hero's journey. So it's almost like a kind of crib note for writing a screenplay. And definitely The Imitation Game doesn't have all of those elements, but there are certain elements which seem to have come to that, which seem to have come from, a template of Hollywood storytelling, which has been imposed onto this true story.
That's very interesting.
It is very, very interesting.
I guess that's, if that is what's happened, whether it's subconscious or conscious, that's what's happened, then their goal is to create a film which will be popular. And if it's seen as that's how you make a popular film, then that's possibly how it came about. As a film, I think it works incredibly well. There is one scene where it didn't quite ring true for me. They've cracked the code, and they're deliberating as to whether to pass on the information to higher command. And one of the members of the team's brother is on one of the boats. As I was watching the film, it was the one moment where I thought, that probably didn't happen like that. But I didn't have a problem with it. I'd love it if that scene didn't have to be in there. But I feel it has. I feel like if it's a war film, and if you think about war, and a lot of people think about war, and they don't think about the individuals, and it's just a way of enabling the necessary empathy for every single person on those boats that died as a result of that decision.
That scene was an excellent way of conveying the sheer magnitude of what they had achieved, and how significant it is that they've cracked the code, and what influence this could have on the war and every individual that is involved in the war. And I think it just, by inserting that scene, it made it ring true, it made it more believable, relatable, because you bring in the family element and the emotion.
I'd love it that if we didn't have to do that, but it's just the way that war is thought about. It's numbers, it's not individuals, and I thought it was a really effective way of bringing that home.
If you want a more cerebral, perhaps more historically accurate version of that scene, it features pretty heavily in the film Enigma, based on Robert Harris's novel, which doesn't feature a character called Alan Turing, The script is written by Tom Stoppard, so as you would expect, it's much more about the ethics of it rather than being about a direct link to someone. This is another point where the film kind of veers off from the history as we know it, because of course in the real history the codebreakers were working with the military intelligence to decide which targets could be saved and how, and all the different excuses that they came up with, so that the Germans didn't suspect they had a code-breaking machine. In the film, it's really the code-breakers against the military, which is you see why they've made that change, but it's maybe a little disrespectful to all the people working on that mission. The first interview with Charles Dance as the military commander, everything felt so loaded that here's Alan Turing, who has just appeared from nowhere. Here's Charles Dance, who is basically just a military buffoon, as far as we can see. Alan Turing kind of runs circles around him. So that conflict just felt really forced to me.
Was it not in reality that he was a very capable mind who was also interested in code cracking?
Absolutely. Well, that
came through in the play, didn't it?
Absolutely. I think that, and I think the family do.
Yeah, I think that's
with it. But the military has been celebrated in film enough, and it's about time we celebrated the mathematicians and the code breakers.
Absolutely, but there were thousands of people working, even just at Bletchley Park. There were thousands of people working there.
I don't think there was any parts that felt inauthentic. Because I just thoroughly enjoyed the whole film. You just swept along with it, and I think. Absolutely. I think if I'd gone into the film having known more about Alan Turing in the first place, then maybe I would have picked up on a few things that had been changed or a few parts that had been added for maybe added dramatisation, but I just thoroughly enjoyed the film.
If the previous incarnations of the story have been more historically accurate, great, but they haven't got the story out there quite as much as this film is doing, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's my question, is if the mission is to get the story out there, how true to the real story should it be? If people watch this film and kind of think, oh, yeah, no, I'd love to read more about Alan Turing, and then they start to read, for example, the biography, Andrew Hodges' biography, which is being sold in a tie-in edition. They go and read this, and they're like, oh, okay, that's really different from how it was in the film. Oh, that's complete... I know, what effect does that have? I just find it interesting.
I think I'm a great believer in that the film is a starting point. And again, you can say, this also rings with science fiction, that it's a starting point. If the interest is instilled within you from watching the film, then go away, do your own research and learn more about the subject.
I talked to Benedict about that, and it was quite interesting what he had to say.
We are trying to get a broader audience, and in achieving that, Alan will actually have his story known by more people. But we're not trying to do that by desensitising the story at all. Yeah. We're trying to do that by making a really good movie. What we do is sort of, we do sketches. We do nice little short standards for what they do, which is write the entire textbook. We like the front cover illustration. We're like, oh, this looks interesting.
Yeah.
And that itself is very valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think there is a new attitude that science is. We're realizing how integral, important, and inspiring science is, and it actually can be something that's properly part of our lives.
Absolutely.
And not something that's seen as being done by people in lab coats behind closed doors. We're like, the more complex our lives are getting with science. I think the more we need to know about it and the more intrigued we are. It's important. Where would we be without penicillin and anaesthetic? Where would we be without viral controls for AIDS and preventative medicines for malaria? Best sort of investigations of that through art can sort of reveal that again, can renew our faith in what the positives are in science, what we can all aspire to through science. And I think it's both great for film culture, but it's also great for, even greater in a way, for education, for our understanding of the world and the people that have helped shape it.
I think that's wonderful, and films like The Imitation Game should definitely be posters or front covers leading people in to find out more about the history. I think that's just my question of, when you're making a film, of course you're going to compress things, you're going to dramatise things, you're going to maybe stick two characters together and all these kind of things, of course. You've got to get a lot of history into 2 hours. But when the events of the film directly contradict what we know about history, I'm just interested by what that means, by by what people take away from that.
I think I view it the same way that I see that, and I know other people don't, but I view it the same way that I see science. And if the science is completely cut across and isn't true, I don't mind. And if the history is, I don't mind. It's a more difficult thing, I think, with history, particularly where there's individuals involved. But I think that they're in the game of telling stories, and I think this film does that incredibly well. I think it's a brilliant story, told incredibly well, whether it's the actual story or not. Mm-hmm. It's close enough for me. I've got a quote here from Ina Payne, who was Alan Turing's niece, she says, I've seen it twice, talking about the film. I've seen it twice. It was great. Benedict Cumberbatch portrayed Alan very well. He played the part with great sensitivity, and it was very moving at the end. Also, Keira Knightley was very good indeed as Joan Clarke. They seemed to get the relationship just right in the film, and the film really did honour to my uncle, and it should make everyone more aware of his immense achievements.
I feel that the fact that it was close enough for his family, that says an awful lot, and I feel that as long as nobody is misrepresented in a film, then I would have to absolutely agree.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that the Enigma film also changed it and moved characters and changed the way that characters were. What is it about the actual story that isn't interesting enough for a film?
Well, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think there are many more stories to be told about it. Okay. It's a rich period. There's loads of wonderful stuff in there. So there are other films. Personally, I was sort of almost hoping for something closer to the film of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, another fantastic Benedict Cumberbatch performance and beautiful way to create tension from the smallest kind of points. The scene where he's going into the records office and has to make that substitution is
brilliant.
Electric from almost nothing. From almost nothing. Yeah. So for me, I guess that's almost what I wanted, but that's for me, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was popular, but certainly not on the scale which we think The Imitation Game is going to be. It's done very good box office in the UK. It's just been released in the States, and it's the second highest per screen average of the year so far. Yeah, it's only been released.
Isn't that brilliant? A film about a mathematician.
Hang on. It's only been released in four cinemas.
Oh.
New York and Los Angeles. But the per screen average is really high. So whether it's going to be massive.
Really? Only four cinemas?
Well, sometimes they do that as just trickle it out, just to get word of mouth going, to get some buzz. Just to put that in context, the first per screen average was The Grand Budapest Hotel, directed by Wes Anderson.
Okay.
They're going to roll it out across the country. It's going to be big. There's going to be Oscar nominations at least for this film.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a more arty film that tells the story. If Turing was an outsider, if that's the story, then that can be told in different ways through structure, etc. of the film.
I kept looking at those turning dials. I guess I wanted some more style coming out of that. Something more, I don't know, more tactile. Something, a film that for some reason popped into my head was Barbarian Sound Studio, which came out a couple of years ago, directed by Peter Strickland, which has, it's all based in sound booths, but it's really rich visually and in terms of sound, of course. I don't know, I wanted a bit more of that, getting into Alan Turing's mindset through visuals, through sound.
I see where you're going with that. I'd love to see that film. Can you make it, please? Because I think there's room for that and The Imitation Game.
Well, I'd also like to see the Studio Ghibli animation with the dream sequences, like the Wind Rises.
I said last time that there should only be films about space and the Large Hadron Collider. I'm going to add Bletchley Park and Alan Turing to the list. We can have those three things. So we'll leave The Imitation Game there for the moment, but we've not heard the last of Benedict. We had him on the phone and we had to take the opportunity to speak to him about a few other things. Benedict's played quite a few scientists, actually, including Stephen Hawking on the BBC.
Joseph Hooker in Creation.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Frankenstein.
And I wondered whether that was deliberate.
I do like my scientists. And I think partly it's because, of course, I could never achieve anything that these men and, you know, characters I played have achieved. But I can understand, what I can do for an audience, I guess, is try and understand the connectivity of what made them be able to achieve what they achieve. So basically their humanity, and that's really what actors do as storytellers. I'm just a curious guy. I love further learning. It's one of the privileges of my ridiculously privileged job. Yeah. Just being able to understand, you know, have a fuller, richer understanding of the world I'm in and the people who made an impact on it. And, you know, also these are great stories at the end of the day. It's not really that I want to play scientists or men that are clever.
Yeah.
It's just that they're great stories.
Brilliant. So are there any scientists that Benedict Cumberbatch hasn't portrayed?
I dare say there are. It's funny, I actually asked him if there were any scientists he'd like to see portrayed, and he started out by saying he wasn't really well informed enough, but as you'll see, he was.
I think the struggle, the race to, you know, DNA, that Crichton, I think those two.
Yeah.
There's definitely a film in that.
Yeah.
I think the Joseph Hooker or Isambard Kingdom Brunel, God, the Pasquale, I mean, all the French scientists. Marie Curie. Oh,
blimey, of course.
We need more amazing roles for women. So, you know, that would be one.
So I didn't just ask Benedict. I also asked Laura and Ben. And the question is, can you pitch to me an idea for a film about a scientist? Laura.
I was thinking about this, and from what you said earlier about you only want films about space exploration.
Yeah.
I believe I missed something. Alan Turing.
Yeah, and
CERN.
CERN.
Yeah.
Flippin' love CERN.
Our subscribers love CERN.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true.
Our subscriber loves CERN.
Our subscriber.
Sorry.
You would only like to watch films.
Yes.
About those four topics. Yes. However, I propose that you would like to watch a film about the Edwardian equivalent of space travel.
I dare say I would. Go on.
So. Okay, so the Edwardian equivalent of space travel would be about Douglas Mawson. Sorry, Sir Douglas Mawson was an explorer who worked alongside Ernest Shackleton, Robert Falcon Scott, Roald Amundsen. However, he had no interest in racing to the South Pole, unlike his colleagues, and he was more interested in the scientific research. So he almost lost his life mapping unknown Antarctic regions. And basically 2/3 of the crew were scientists engaged in geological, marine and wildlife research. Their measurements that were carefully made in the face of these tragic losses and adverse weather conditions are some of the most valuable scientific data in existence. This happened in February 1913, and in 2013, scientists set off on the same expedition that they did to collect the same data to use as a comparison, and I think that would be such a beautiful way of opening a film.
Oh, lovely. How much money do you want?
How much money? An awful lot, because I would like to go to Antarctica. I'd
like to dabble. Are you going to go and do it?
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to star in the movie, write the movie.
Have you ever been?
To Antarctica.
Who would you play?
Who would I play?
Yeah.
Would it be a kind of Julia kind of thing of both timelines going on together? So it's
that,
you
yes.
in the present, Meryl Streep.
Oh.
Yes, I do like that idea.
You'd like to be played by Meryl Streep.
I don't know about that, my
Or we could just bring back Amy Adams as you.
There we go.
Excellent. Let's do that. Ben.
I don't know if I can follow that. It sounds fantastic. I'd love to see you and Meryl on screen together. If you can get Stanley Tucci in there as well. I started thinking, we mentioned Ada Lovelace before.
Yeah.
She had a short but fascinating life. Mm-hmm. Writer of the first algorithm, working with Charles Babbage on the early computers in the early 19th century, between poetry of her father, Byron, and pure mathematics. Absolutely fascinating. Died at 36 or something. So, yeah, lots in there. There was a film already, which I haven't seen, called Conceiving Ada with Tilda Swinton, which actually sounds a little along the Julia lines, that there's a modern storyline and then it goes back to the 19th century. Haven't seen it. There's also a brilliant web comic called The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage. Have a look at that. Looks like that's coming out as a book early next year as well, and hopefully that'll be a film as well. It's kind of steampunk, imagining that she lived and had these brilliant adventures with Charles Babbage. Okay, so that's kind of been done. I thought it'd be brilliant to have perhaps a mini-series, not a movie. I'm thinking a mini-series, kind of in the vein of Masters of Sex.
What is it?
Masters of Sex.
Yeah.
A dramatisation of Masters and Johnson, who were sex researchers. A really good series.
Who's this guy?
I know.
You haven't seen it? It's brilliant. Michael Sheen is in it. Alison Janney.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think it was on Channel 4. It had a couple of seasons. So anyway, somewhere along the lines of that, the story of the Harvard computers, who were amazing women who worked under Edward Charles Pickering in the late 19th century, early 20th century, to process astronomical data. They included Wilhelmina Fleming. They've got great names.
Yeah.
Annie Jump Cannon, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and Antonia Murray. My favourite,
Cecilia Payne Gaspochin,
who was originally from Wendover in Buckinghamshire, just up the road from where I grew up.
Sounds like it.
she moved to the States because she wanted to be an astronomer, and she thought in the UK the only job she could get was like a primary school teacher. So she went to the USA, worked at Harvard. Her PhD thesis was an explanation for the composition of stars in terms of the relative abundances of hydrogen and helium.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I would watch that.
Yeah, she appears in an episode of the new series of Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. I don't know if she necessarily had the most interesting life. Obviously, she made the voyage across to the USA. I think that would be pretty interesting. She married a man with an interesting surname.
You can always make stuff up as well. That's the thing with the biopic.
Yeah, it's true. But I think this is going to get you, Andrew.
Yeah.
While in school, she created an experiment on the efficacy of prayer. And to do this, she created two groups. One, which was a control group, yeah, of course, that didn't pray.
Yeah.
And after that, she became an agnostic.
Because it proved there was evidence that prayer doesn't work.
We can put it in the film.
I'd like to see the film starting with her voyage to America.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then
someone's praying for her. We pray that you're going to make it. There's waves crashing. Oh, God, we're praying. And then it flashes back to her in school with that scene.
Oh, brilliant.
Amazing.
Yeah, okay, but no, I think all those, there's a great miniseries of all the Harvard computers. I think that'd be wonderful. But yeah. Particularly,
I think you found your next project.
Yeah. I can see what you're doing there, Ben. You've pulled on my heartstrings, but I'm sorry to say it wasn't a competition, and we're going to make both the films.
Yay!
Just going back to what Benedict said there, I'd love to see a film about Watson and Crick, because there's that fascinating story about, as he says, the race to DNA. But there's also the story of, well, let's put it this way, they're both fairly controversial. For example, Francis Crick said, "I don't respect the views of Christianity. I think we need to get them out of the way so that we can understand what this world is really about." And he went on to say that Christianity is okay between two consenting adults, but it shouldn't be taught to children. Controversial. But I'm willing to say it on the podcast. I'm not willing to say the sexist and racist things that Watson says on a regular basis. Interestingly, he's auctioning his Nobel Prize that he got for the DNA discovery. There are campaigns among the scientists on social media to get nobody to bid for it, for obvious reasons. You can't speak to Benedict Cumberbatch at the moment without talking about Sherlock. And Sherlock is often described as the archetypal scientist. And I asked Benedict whether that came into his thinking when performing that role.
He's always been a hero of science, that man, I think. And the beauty about it is that, you know, he doesn't require any magic. He's always been a modern man. And, you know, he was born out of Doyle's fascination with Bell at Edinburgh University, this incredible surgeon who could tell with the first meeting someone's profession, their personal life. You know, he was sort of clairvoyant, seemingly, but it was all through the powers of logical observation. It's wonderful that science can be explored with everything that cinema has to offer as an art form, because you can make ideas real in a way that the written words often can't. You can help kickstart the imagination. If you can make science as magical as something else that sort of transfixes kids through the art of cinema, then you're doing a great service, I think, for science. It's really important to tease people into a fascination with this stuff, to go to a richer, detailed level. And that's film, that's cinema, really. That's what I should see as cinema. I suppose films about biopics are things that can tease you into wanting to learn more, and that's, I think, it's a very valuable arm to our culture.
We've got a job on now to make those films, so we better bring the podcast to a close. I hope you've enjoyed episode 2. We will be posting some links on thecosmicshed.com. Thank you very much to Benedict again for giving us that interview. I hope you found it interesting. Next time, inspired by the new NASA rocket, Orion, which launches this week as we record, we are looking at Apollo 13, and we have an interview with Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes. So, follow us on Twitter, at The Cosmic Shed. Find us on Facebook, or have a look at thecosmicshed.com. That's it for this week. Hope you join us again. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Okay, I can't remember what you said in the last bit. It was the...
It was very, very moving.
And so, it was basically that it was a... Oh, God.
It's almost like you've got a philosopher in your pocket.
Sorry. Carry on. Sorry. Oh.
It's all falling out of my head. I'm going to tell my ear later. It's just falling out.